Welcome to the Wednesday night Brain Pickup Pro teleconference live from Lake Wylie, South Carolina, and Charlotte, North Carolina. Special guest tonight, good long-time business associate. We do a lot of business together and continuing our Building Your Dream Team. A very, very key person as an investor in Building Your Dream Team is an appraiser, and I'm very proud to have very experienced appraiser, investor, and business associate, Brad Kroll. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks, Larry. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. How many appraisals did you do today?
I try to do 2 a day.
Wow. That's strong. 10 a week, man. That is strong. You stay really busy, don't you?
I've been fortunate. Yeah, it goes up and down depending on the markets and what's going on, but it's been pretty steady for a number of years now.
And we've been working together for a long time now. We do quite a bit together. Why don't you start out a little bit and tell people a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure, Larry. I've been appraising residential real estate since 1991.
Uh-huh.
It's been full-time since that time.
Uh-huh.
And I'm based out of Charlotte, North Carolina, and we cover the market here and then a county out in each direction, which is generally the way appraisers work. And I just specialize in residential properties.
Uh-huh. Now, how did you get into appraising?
Well, it's been a second career for me.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah, I started out. I have an engineering degree from the University of Illinois. Worked in
corporate
sales.
I'm just kidding.
And my basketball team is playing right now. You know what kind of sacrifice I'm making here.
I hear you, man, and I really appreciate that.
and I worked for corporate America for 10, 12 years, and always had an interest in real estate, and started taking appraising courses. Maybe thought I was going to do some investing, like a lot of your people do, and found an appraiser was a good job, is a good fit for me. So I took all the courses and then became a trainee, and I found I liked it, and I can make a good living at it. And so I've been doing it ever since.
That's great. That is really good, man. So it's a second career for you. I didn't know that. Wow. Now, you mentioned that you're based in Charlotte and you go out about one county. Why would an appraiser only want to go in areas that they're close to?
Well, you have to develop knowledge in your market. We're there to interpret data, but you have to keep up with the economy and the market areas that you go to. Is important to do a proper valuation, but also you have to drive to these properties, and time is money, and we can't be driving an hour and a half, 2 hours to go look at a property and then all the way back, and you just can't do enough of them that way, and then you don't know the market there.
That's true.
So fortunately, living in a major metropolitan area like Charlotte, most of the housing density is around this area, so you've got plenty of work. Once you're established, just in that, and most lenders, most of the lenders deal with in a localized basis as well, and that's where we get most of our business through the financial institutions and their clients and people that apply for loans and things. So it kind of works. You basically serve what their client needs are as well.
Exactly. And I guess there's a lot to be said for you have to know your market, as you mentioned, because I'm sure it would be tough for you to go down and do an appraisal cold, say, in Columbia or in Spartanburg. And there's things about certain areas and neighborhoods and cities and officials and growth that's going on that if you came in from out of town a couple hours away that you may not be familiar with.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's just start with the basics. Most people talk about market value. Define, what is market value according to an appraiser?
Well, Larry, market value is what the conclusion that we're trying to reach in the appraisal report. And the definition of market value essentially is what is the most likely sales price for the property if it was marketed, say, with a realtor sign up or it got full exposure to the marketplace, what would a knowledgeable buyer and the willing seller most likely arrived at as the sale price. And now this is still an estimate of value because the property isn't really being sold.
Right.
So there's kind of a range there, and you're supposed to pick kind of in the middle of that range and try to be fair about that. So it's not what it might sell for, or to be on the other end, you know, too conservative. It's supposed to be what's the most likely sales price with full exposure to the market, what would this property sell for in its current condition, generally speaking.
Right. And, you know, if it wasn't for sale, it hasn't sold. But is there a difference between doing an appraisal for a bank for a refinance versus for a purchase?
The mechanics are basically the same. They should be. And because you're still estimating, you know, there's still, if you look at the URAR form, which is typically the two,
uh-huh.
It says what is the conclusion, which is most people flip to at the very end.
They look at page two, the bottom right.
They look at the pictures. The lender will look at the pictures, and then the conclusion. And if you look at that line, it's what is market value.
Right.
And market value for refinance is really should be the same as market value for a purchase.
And a lot of people want to know, do you need or want a copy of that sales contract if the property is being sold to help determine your appraisal?
Well, we're not to be influenced by that.
Right.
That being said, but we do have to have that because there's essential information that goes into the appraisal report that has to be listed. The sales price has to be listed.
Uh-huh.
Any seller concessions and the date of it has to be listed. And then we have to discuss that our conclusion has to be reconciled to that sales contract. You know, does it support that value? Do we think it's worth more than that value, which can be the case?
Mm-hmm. Especially working with investors, right?
Yeah, because, you know, you should be buying, you know, investors are going to buy it below market value.
Right.
You know, there's opportunities there.
Distressed sales, bank foreclosure sales, that sort of thing.
Right, right. And we also have to disclose within the last 3 years any other subject sales. And we have to kind of analyze that little chain of what's happened. And that particularly gets fairly complicated with investor properties and distressed properties where there, you know, there's been a bank foreclosure or some
right.
sort of situation that's created this situation. And we have to disclose all that.
And how far back do you have to go?
Right now it's 3 years.
You have to go back 3 years. If the property's changed hands 3 times, you have to list all 3 transactions.
Exactly. If it's changed 10 times in those 3 years,
wow.
all have to be listed, and that's full disclosure. And we're mandated by federal law to do that.
Wow, you guys have to do a lot of research when you do an appraisal.
Yeah, and interestingly, now there's some new guidelines coming out, and you'll see them here this summer. Now the comparable sales have to be analyzed the same way back 3 years.
The comparable sales do?
Comparables as well.
What's here's the key question everybody wants to know. What's that going to do to the price of an appraisal? So now you not only have to go back with one, you have to go back with four.
Unfortunately, they're all the prices will stay the same.
Really?
We're asked more. Well, appraisal the price for an appraisal really hasn't changed much since I've been doing it in 91. But we're doing more and more work and more goes into it.
Uh-huh.
However, at the same time, we're becoming more efficient.
More automated, I guess.
Much more automated than we are before, so it works out kind of a wash in that respect. It's what the lender will be willing to pay. And they're, you know, and unfortunately, many lenders consider an appraisal a commodity, and the commodities are, you know, whatever the price. If I try to raise my price, you know, if at $50, someone else won't, and then you won't get the business. So you kind
right.
of end up having to hold your line on the prices. But
that's true.
And normally, you're not going to have a lot of sales activity with your three comparable sales.
Uh-huh.
But again, now with investor properties, and that's what our audience is, and you know, the work I do for you guys. Sometimes that's going to be the case even on your comparables, and so there's going to be a whole lot of disclosures
right.
going on there.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago about market value. How does an appraiser go about in determining market value?
Well, Basically, we look at closed sales in the past 12 months of similar homes in that neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you start with. You start with a home that's of similar age, similar square footage, hopefully right in what we will call a subdivision or a neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And these typical are MLS, multiple listing data sheets that are available, of course, to us through subscribing. They're not necessarily private sales. Because those then get exposed to the market, and they can be high, they can be low, they can be anything. And we don't typically use private sales because we don't have information then about the subject home.
Are you allowed to do that if someone knows of a private sale?
We're allowed to do that, especially if they're needed. If you don't have a lot of good comps in the neighborhood,
uh-huh.
and it's a unique home, and you don't want to go 3 miles away for some reason. You know, if you've got some good private sales, an appraiser can and should use those.
Yeah, so like if we were selling a house and we knew, hey, the neighbor down the street just sold theirs, as an individual to mm-hmm. another individual, and, contact them, you could get the information directly through them.
Yeah, and you'd have to go the extra, nobody likes to do extra work, but we'd actually have to interview either the buyer or the seller in that, and they're usually
verify.
Under no obligation to us. Because we want to know the condition of the home.
Sure.
And that's important in doing your adjustments and analyzing your data between your adjusting your comparable to your subject, where on the MLS sheets, you've got a lot of realtor comments that go into that.
Uh-huh.
And the realtor, of course, is available if you would need clarification.
Uh-huh.
So there's lots of data we get on those MLS sheets. At least in our part of the country, they're I think the integrity and the quality and the detail is exceptional, and they're essential to what we can do, because we're going to take those data sheets and use those square footages that are on there. We use your bedroom bath counts. We have a deck or a porch or what kind of heating system. We're going to check the size of the lot, but that's on there, and all that data gets flowed into that. Full appraisal report,
uh-huh.
and needs to be adjusted. So we kind of like having the MLS data because all the details in those.
Exactly, because there's a lot of stuff to sift through, isn't there?
Yeah, you end up with your best, what you call three comparables,
uh-huh.
but it really gets distilled down from hundreds of potential comparables. And you can enter in parameters now on our automated system. Back in the old days, you had published books, and you just had to flip through the pages and try to decide which is your better comps. And it was a pretty long process. But now you can search by varying criteria, and that's how I search for my comps. I do it by area. I do it by size of the lot. I do it by size of the house and by date, of course, so it can only go back 12 months, and 6 months is preferable. And I can enter all those parameters and see how many comps I get. So I try to get it down to 10 or 12, and then I'll look at those and then pick my best, end up picking your best three. But you start with literally thousands that are on the system and decide which are your best three to rely on.
I guess that's probably why, Brad, that if you get three different appraisals from three different appraisers, you're going to have three different numbers.
You will.
You have so many that you have to go, sift through.
It's appraising is part science and part art,
uh-huh.
and it is only an estimate. But you should be within just I would say 5%. If it's a $100,000 house, assuming that's the market value, say $100,000,
right?
Good appraisers should be within easily in 5%. I would think on that. In a market where you've got active data and flowing, if you're out in rural areas, it gets to be very difficult to get a handle on what something might be worth.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a key point a while ago that I think it's important for everybody to hear again is when you're looking for sales, you're looking for sales no older than 12 months, preferably 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
What about the distance between your comps that you're looking for? Distance from the subject. Is there a rule of thumb for that?
Well, it really depends on your density of housing.
Uh-huh.
If you've got a subdivision mm-hmm. that's got hundreds of homes, certainly there's no reason to have to go outside that subdivision. You'll
right.
have enough active data.
Uh-huh.
as the areas become less and less dense, you have to start moving out away from those areas. Now, but you want to stay in a similar quality of home, similar age of home. So sometimes, you know, often you can find another subdivision that's nearby, and that's okay. The problem with, and our reports get reviewed by underwriting at the lenders, and if they look at and we have to produce a location map that shows the subject and where the comps are picked, and if they look at that and they see that you've got a lot of streets and obviously then density of housing, and you've gone 3 miles to pick your comps, they'll be suspicious that you did that for a reason, and sometimes the reason is to have an inflated value, and that's not going to get past underwriting guidelines. But it is just a function of what's available and looking at your density of housing. Anytime that we have to make a comment, if we go past a mile, if all three comps were further than a mile from the subject, we have to discuss that, why we did it, and why it was necessary, and that are these still located, even though they're that far out, are they still in similar neighborhoods?
And that's part of your addendum, right?
That would be, that would flow into a whole lot of addendum of verbiage that that the underwriter's going to want to see there.
Right. You know, and I think it's also important to point out that I've heard so many people say, you know, well, I know of a house that just sold down the street. Why don't they use that? Well, and I know you'll be the first one to say this, is a sale doesn't necessarily mean a comp.
Right. And oftentimes a homeowner, they'll be talking, in my experience, about something that's listed for sale.
Yeah, not hasn't sold, but listed.
Yeah, and of course we can't use that yet because people could ask anything for the house. It may be priced properly, or it may be inflated, or for all we know, it may be too low.
Right.
It could be anything, and we can only use closed sales, and because at that point you've got your willing buyer, and you've got a contract, and it's closed, and now it's a done deal. And then you can use that number. Now, most appraisers will be happy to take in that information if it's a sale from a homeowner, from an investor, from whoever. If it's a professional appraiser, he's not going to say whether he's going to use it or not at that point because he hasn't done his full analysis yet.
Right.
But sometimes data doesn't get entered into the MLS system properly or at all, and so I will write down, if someone mentions the home down the street sold, I'll take down the address, the information that the homeowner's got, and I'll check into it and make sure that I've looked at that and analyzed it. It may not end up in one of the three, but it may very well be. Sometimes they don't get the realtors don't enter the area or the sub-area properly, and it won't get into my search results.
Oh, yeah, and, well, there's nothing you can do about that if you don't see it.
Right. There's no way you would ever, you know, you would know because you don't live in a neighborhood. You didn't know the thing sold. It could have sold next door, you know, last week. And if they didn't enter it right in the data, it's not going to come up in your system. So I welcome anybody to give me additional, not only information about the subject. You know, we replace the heat pump or the gas or the roof. You know, all this. We're totally objective in this process. And the more data we have about the subject or the market around it, you know. I don't take any offense to people telling me things. Certainly, they know their neighborhood probably better than I do to some degree.
Sure, and every little bit of information that you can get helps.
Sure.
Now, I know there's different kinds of appraisals. Can you explain to that a little bit?
Well, there's different kinds of appraisals, and there's different kinds of appraisal reports. I guess I can start with different types of appraisal reports. Some can be as simple as desktop appraisals, and more of these kind of things are done. These they're not what we call the old full-blown walk-through, go visit and measure the house appraisal.
Right.
There's these shorter versions that are sometimes used. Now, I'll go through these. They don't often apply to investors because they're more sophisticated properties and the lenders want the full, complete thing normally. But this may be interesting. People that are just refinancing their own house or something might get by with some of these. The simple one is just a desktop analysis and review, where the appraiser never actually goes and visits the house. They take the data off the tax card, which is the heated living area comes off of that, and uses that to compare. He'll still look at comparables then, but he has to take data, property data, off a tax card. That's usually where it comes from, and that data is imperfect. But that's the understanding, and sometimes if someone has very good credit and it's on their house and it's owner-occupied, sometimes they do these because the banks, you know, don't pay us near that much to do these simple desktop quick kind of, and there's no delay then. You can do it, you know, within a day or two to turn a thing around. I mean, it only takes 30 minutes or so.
And you don't have to even go out, right?
You don't. But more common is what you call a drive-by appraisal, where you do actually drive by the house, hopefully slow down enough where you get a good picture.
Yeah, where it's not a blur.
Yeah. And you just, so the thing does exist. But again, you're not getting out of the car, walking inside the house to see the condition or measuring it.
Mm-hmm.
But you do at least verify that, you know, what, like, the setting is in the neighborhood and the site, you know, is fairly level. It's not something unusual. Or it's not near a textile plant. You know, textile plants are okay, but it's not near a chemical plant, say,
right.
Or right by a freeway. You know, there's a lot of, it's good to
or
at least run the field. Yeah, see where it sets. It's not burned down. It does exist. Here's a picture of it, which will go in the report.
Sure.
But then your analysis is still based off a tax card, which is imperfect, and you haven't measured it, and it could be anything. But that's understood, and there's a disclaimer in our report. You know, the tax card says it's 1,500 square feet, and that's what we're going by.
Now, when would a lender use a drive-by appraisal?
Again, these are done mostly owner-occupied.
For a strong borrower, I would imagine.
Strong borrower with good credit rating, because the bank figures that it's unlikely that they're going to get this loan back or the house back, so the collateral is not near as much important as it would be otherwise.
Now, I just did, and I know you have other reports to talk about, but I just redid my home equity line of credit.
Mm-hmm.
We just increased it. We actually got it doubled so we could go out and buy more houses at one time.
Sure.
And then refinance them and get the money back. But they said they were going to do an electronic evaluation where they didn't even call an appraiser. They just, I don't know what it was, but it took them like 2 days and they were done.
Yeah, the large lending institutions now, it's more and more common to do what we call AVMs, what are automated valuation models.
I think he mentioned that, automated something.
Right, and these are statistical analysis. They're, again, primarily, they're centered on the tax data of the subject and the square footage, but they do a regression analysis, statistical analysis of your neighborhood data. They come up with just a dollars per square foot. They multiply it by the tax square footage, and there's your number.
Wow!
And if that number is good enough to suit what the loan package is and supports what they want to do, even though everybody understands it's not very accurate,
right?
It could be high, it could be low, it's just very uncertain. As long as that supports what needs to be done on the loan, yes, it can be done very cheaply and very quickly, and particularly with, let's say, high quality, you know, grade applicants and a large institution, they can sometimes get by with that. Now, if it doesn't, then they have a way to step it up into maybe a drive-by next, and if that still doesn't work, then they can do a walkthrough.
Right. Yeah, I was kind of surprised that the electronic valuation would work down here in Lake Wylie. You know, although it is, I live in a big neighborhood. It's a gated community, but it's Lake Wylie, kind of a small area just outside of Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. Well, these programs are becoming more and more sophisticated, and unfortunately, and to some degree, they're taking the place of a lot of appraisal work that's out there, and it's really our profession's in a way in a declining business because there's less and less of the walkthroughs, traditional walkthroughs going on. There's more and more of these AVMs and people loaning off tax value, and frankly, the regulations are just gotten looser and looser since the S&L crisis is barely a memory anymore. And each year it gets looser and looser, and until there's another crisis, it'll just kind of keep going that way.
Yeah, until things change.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the desktop and then the drive-by. What other kind of reports are there?
Well, after those two, you pretty much step up to what we're more familiar with the walkthrough, the full two-page URAR, where we come out and measure the house, and we make note of special features and the condition of paint, paper, and carpet, and the site you know, the size of the site, where it sits in the neighborhood, and garage and porches and decks and fireplaces or not, and all, just everything you can possibly think of gets detailed in that report, and then at some point analyzed and compared to the comparables. So you've got a whole grid to work with of making these adjustments and fine-tuning your final estimate of value.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Now, for investor reports, we also have to put in a rent analysis, which is just a one-page form, but it's got three comparable rent houses.
That's what the 1007, you call that, right?
Yeah, that's 1007, and this is required for most income properties that I've been involved in. And these rent, again, these are similar to the sales comps in that they should be fairly near the subject in location. They should be similar size, but these are actually have to be rented. And these are not what they're asking for rent. These are houses that have leases, and we have to put that lease information on all those and then adjust, you know, a little bit for square footage, but hopefully they're fairly similar anyhow, and come up with a conclusion there, and we consider that then market rent.
Uh-huh.
And the market rent then should compare to, you know, what the actual rent is or the projected rent. And then that flows into another form, the 216,
mm-hmm.
which is the income analysis.
Right.
Which basically goes through, I'm sure the investors are doing this on their own anyhow. Okay, here's my rent income, say, per year.
Uh-huh.
Here's my expenses and my reserves for replacement. And, you know, am I coming out? And there's my mortgage payment. Okay, how am I coming out at the end of that?
Right.
Am I making anything? It's like a cash flow income analysis kind of sheet. And so that's another form that we have to fill out for income properties, mm-hmm. typically.
Wow. A lot of paperwork.
It is a lot of paperwork. I'm about 50% in the field and 60% in the office.
Wow. Wow, yeah. Let me ask you this question, Brad. We do a lot of buy a lot of properties that need a lot of work done to them, a lot of bank-owned properties and, you know, rehab-type properties. And sometimes we appraise them, I guess, as is, which to me, you know, like when I'm buying a house and somebody says, well, it needs a lot of work, but right now it's worth X. Well, really what it's worth now doesn't really matter. It's what's it going to be worth after we do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a little bit of difference between the as-is and an as-repaired or a subject-to or after-repaired appraisal?
Sure. Oftentimes, because of the for investor properties, there are loan packages that will loan in the front end off of what you call an as-repaired value. And that's one of the different types of appraisals that I can do. I guess let me compare it. The simplest case is if it's a new home. I can appraise a new home based on the plans and specifications given to me by a builder. So I know the site. I pretend as if it was finished and then compare it to the market at this time.
Uh-huh.
What would it be worth? So even though it's an empty lot right now, I can appraise that as built. So in the same way, I can do an as repaired on a subject property. Now I have to have the full list of things that are to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you know, you're going to put in new carpet and, you know, new paint. You're going to repair all what we call deferred maintenance, you know, where you have to take care of wood rotted things and, you know, something's falling apart here, or you need to replace an appliance there. So, but I need that full list of things because that has to go on the report. And then I can appraise it as if all those things were done, what would it then be worth? And then at some point in the future, you know, normally, then when everything's done, then we'll go out and confirm that.
Yeah, afterwards, then you have to do a reinspection, right?
Typically, yeah, to get your, at least at that point, you're doing your long-term financing or locking something in, or maybe, you know, you're selling it or, you know, whatever at that point. But
right.
Yeah, typically we're called back in then to check on those things.
Right.
But we can redo it. So we don't care really what the as-is value now. I mean, as-is is worth $25,000 because it's in terrible shape, and that's why you're getting a good deal on it.
Right.
We ignore all that. Now we have to disclose that,
mm-hmm.
and we can analyze that but we can still say it's worth, you know, $70,000 once all these things are repaired, because then it, you know, we're comparing it then to similar homes that have that are in good shape as well in the neighborhood.
Now, is that called an update, or what is that called when you go back and reinspect it and make sure everything's done? That's not an update, is it? That's just a final inspection, right?
Yeah. Sometimes if the lender set it up originally where it's just a subject to,
uh-huh.
I can just fill out a one-page, it's called a completion certificate,
uh-huh.
and take some inside pictures, and I just check a box, say everything's completed per the original appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to redo the whole appraisal because some time has passed. And say it's been 3-4 months, and now we're gonna, you know, now we do the income and the rent thing this time around. Sometimes have to do that on the front end for an as repaired appraisal if they're getting your financing packages.
Maybe they're getting a hard money or rehab or private loan or something,
mm-hmm.
and they don't need the the 1007 or the rent schedule.
Yeah.
So all they really need up front is what's it going to be worth after this list of repairs is completed.
Right. Yeah. And then if it's been 3-4 months, then we have to update it with new comparables anyhow.
Uh-huh.
You want to see the latest on that. So
that was one of the things I wanted to ask you. How long is an appraisal good for?
About 12 hours.
I hear you.
One day. Yeah.
From a lending point of view.
From a lending point of view, typically they'll accept it. I think it's maybe 90 days.
90 days.
After that, you know, they're going to start, you know, deciding if they need an update, which it also depends on the comparables. If you've got a good underwriter that's doing some analysis, they'll look. Since we have to pick comps that are within 12 months, of the original report,
mm-hmm.
if those comps were pushing that 12 month, say they were 10 and 11,
right,
and now they've fallen out of date, so they might want those replaced with something new.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. I never really thought about that. If the comps run out of date.
Yeah, but if you typically, if you work with a, you know, say it was my appraisal, I have to update it, they're not going to normally charge you anywhere near a full fee.
Wow.
To do an updated. An appraisal.
Sure, but you got to do something for the little bit of work you have to do.
Right. It just, you know, charge based on the
time.
What ends up being having to done. Usually he's going to have if they need a new effective date, which is kind of what we're getting at.
Uh-huh.
Effective date of the appraisal, then you have to go back out and reinspect the property so that you've been in there and been inside it.
Sure.
And then so that's a minimum of, you know, some field work and then changing your comps, but your property information is basically the same, so
good.
There's some savings there.
Now, Brad, when you go out and to inspect a home that you're going to appraise, what all are you looking at, and what are you looking for?
Well, we're trying to put ourselves in the position of a typical buyer in some ways, you know. So some of it is an impression that you get from how does the property show, but on a technical basis, primarily we're measuring it to get the square footage because that's the most critical part.
Uh-huh.
And then we're looking for the condition of the inside and the outside, from, you know, whether it's siding and vinyl and what kind of condition that's in, to the inside, is it new paint, or what kind of condition is the carpet or the flooring in. And then you go into your features. Have you got hardwood flooring, have you got high ceilings, crown moldings, you know, decks and porches, and how is your rooms flow? How is your layout? You know,
right.
we don't like things like you have to go through this bedroom to get to that next bedroom where they added on in the back maybe, and you see some of those, you know, because then we have to talk about that because that's called functional obsolescence, and you need to have separate access to each bedroom through a hallway and such. You don't want to have to go through one bedroom to get to another, or all the bedrooms are on one side and the bathrooms, you got to walk through the living room to get to it. You know, that wouldn't be good. But typically, you stay with just the standard things,
uh-huh.
and then I guess if we're from an investor, let me answer. I guess from an investor point of view too, is when we go back out and say the property's been rehabbed, we're making sure that all the deferred maintenance, because the property had been neglected in the past, has been fixed. So things like wood rot and chip paint and peeling paint, you know, the windowsills where it get like that.
Right.
You know, soft subflooring. You know, if the home is still more similar to a distressed home than it is a marketable, nice new home, then there's going to be a problem with getting a valuation that the investor is going to be looking for. So there's really no shortcuts on that. You got to, you know, an experienced appraiser going in there, and he's going to notice things. And so it's just all those things need to be fixed. Any what we call deferred maintenance has to be fixed. Now, if the carpet can be cleaned, you know, if you're going to put this in a rental fleet and the carpet can be cleaned and it's still in good shape, you know, that's fine. You don't have to do, you don't have to make it perfect as you might say if you were to sell it.
Right.
But anything that's what we call deferred maintenance has to be repaired.
And that's something I tell people too when I'm trying to buy a property and they say, "Oh, my house doesn't need any work." So one of the things I might say to them is when we send an appraiser out, is the appraiser going to make note of anything that may need to be done to your house, such as some of the walls need to be painting, or maybe there's a weak spot in the floor in the bathroom next to the tub, or maybe there's some water stains on the ceiling, any of that. And I like to bring those things up to let them think about, well, an appraiser's going to, yeah, I could use painting, I need new people. And, you know, what is the appraiser going to see when he comes out there that he's not going to like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because everybody at that point wants the highest number they can get on the appraisal.
Absolutely.
And to do that, you know, you've got a knowledgeable appraiser. Or in this case, what I say, we're supposed to put ourselves in the shoes of a knowledgeable buyer, and they're gonna, you know, what would they notice, and what would they like, and what they not like. And for the appraiser to put you at what we call the top end of the range of sales available, the subject has to deserve to be there by having all these things, you know, done and taken care of.
Exactly. It's kind of like the theory, you know, you could sell your car for more if it's just clean, you know?
Yeah. And the impression people get when they walk in, presentation's important. Now, we try to be objective, and, you know, we're not going to be, you know, swayed too much by, you know, decorations. I mean, I tell you, funny, we don't even notice personal property that's in it, so the way the house is decorated really doesn't matter too much to an appraiser on the presentation. Now, it doesn't really apply necessarily to investor properties because they're vacant or your tenants are in there by then. But we're taking we're looking at the structure.
Right. You're looking at everything that's going to make a difference to an informed buyer. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, sometimes you run into a situation where, you know, hey, I've already got an appraisal, can you use it? Or I just need to call my other lender and get them to send it to you. Who actually owns an appraisal, and who does the appraiser work for?
Well, by the federal guidelines, the whoever the lender is my client, and they own the appraisal. Even if the borrower or the investor paid me directly or indirectly, which doesn't seem right or fair, but that's the way that the lending regulations are set up, that they actually, once I prepare a report, where at the top, on page one there towards the top, there's a place that says lender/client.
Right.
If I put, you know, Wachovia, Bank of America, whatever lender goes there, if I put that in a report and submit it, they own it. They control it, and I can't even give a copy to a third party, including the borrower. Even if he paid me $300 directly at the inspection, I really can't give him a report without the approval of the lender, which normally you don't have a problem. By federal law, they have to give you a copy of the appraisal report.
Right.
And oftentimes, just to save time, sometimes, you know, I'll ask and they'll say, okay, yeah, you can send them the report. But they have control over it, which means that if you walk from them and go to some other lender and then call me to do something, I can't do anything.
Right.
Without the permission, which we can go back and you can get your file released from that original lender.
And then you can redo it with the new lender client's name on it.
Yeah, then I can reassign it. But my hands are tied as far as me being able to do things on my own.
Right. And it doesn't, does it matter who ordered the appraisal?
No.
Doesn't matter.
No. Once, now, sometimes, in a rare case, I will do an appraisal for an owner or an investor directly. At that point, there's no bank involved.
Right.
They want to know what it's worth for some reason. Or a homeowner wants to sell his house. It's in, if you guys know our market here in Charlotte, say it's in Myers Park, and they don't think they need a realtor because the market's so hot that they could sell it without a realtor, and they're going to save the commission, and you know.
Right.
But they want to know what it's worth, and it makes sense because they don't want to leave money on, you know, thousands of dollars by underpricing it. So they'll actually hire an appraiser, and for me to tell them what their house is worth, or you know, estimate what I think their house is worth. In that case, I don't. The bank's not involved, so my client is the homeowner or is the investor if it's done directly. But if I'm instructed to put a bank in there, a lending institution on my report, and it's submitted to that bank, then that's my client at that point.
Wow. That's interesting. You get a lot of different stories about that and different people. Oh, yeah, just go ahead and send that over. Or we'll go ahead and send that to you or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get calls, and they think they can use it, and they can use it, and then they try to close, and they find they can't use it.
Yeah. When it goes to underwriting,
yeah, it has to be in the right lender's name. So, I guess the moral to the story is, I decide who your lender is before your appraiser.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, shop your deals, check your rates, and you know, decide you know who you want to work with, and then let them you know handle the appraisal part.
Plus, not that it's a big deal, I guess, but all lenders have a list of approved appraisers.
Sure, they're going to have their preferences as well.
Exactly, but what I said by what I meant by not that it matters that much because, like, if you're not on one of our lenders' approved list, all you have to do is submit your the resume and your information, license, all that, and a couple of samples, and you know a week later you're on their list.
Well, yeah, and they'll make exceptions even easier than that. Because they want, you know, they want the deal. I mean, they want business, and if you've already, you know, paid for this appraisal, and now you're having to, you know, you couldn't use it for some other reason, you know, with that lender, but that lender's released it. I think any new lender would generally, as long as you're what we call state certified, which anybody that's out there appraising, you know, the way we do for fee appraisals is state licensed. They're going to accept that work.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about property flipping from an appraisal standpoint. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. I think I'd like to say that there's two kinds of property flipping. There's the legal kind and the illegal kind.
Right. The government definition and then the...
Yeah, and we're involved, of course, in the legal kind. But I guess the illegal is a little simpler. Let me start with that, where somebody buys a property for, you know, say $50,000. It's distressed property, and doesn't do anything to it, and then sets up a sale to generally a fictitious buyer for $85,000. And they've got a bunch of people involved, you know, in the collusion of it, but it gets through. You got an appraiser that's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. You got attorneys, you got lenders, you got a whole bunch of people, and you've read it in the papers. And so you've got an inflated sales price and an inflated appraisal to support that, and you've got a lender on the hook for something that's way over market value.
And fraudulent buyers and all that.
And it's just. And it doesn't get found out till later, and then it's a mess. You know, that's, you know, and sometimes you got closings on the same day I've seen, and then it's just simply real estate fraud, and that's property flipping. And some people, and they talk about that, and that's why there's so many regulations now on me disclosing past sales of the subject and the comparables, is to kind of avoid trying to minimize some of that. And but still, property flipping can. On a legal side, an investor side, is simply fixing up the property, increasing its value and its market value, and then reselling it.
Buy low, sell high.
Sure.
Create value, add value.
And I do appraisals in those situations fairly, you know, all the time. Sometimes they stay in a rental fleet, but sometimes they're resold,
mm-hmm.
and for a profit. And sometimes you've got wholesalers, as your investor group knows about. And so, you know, there's opportunities there, totally legal,
mm-hmm.
and there's no collusion, there's no inflated appraisals involved. It's just an opportunity because of a distressed property, and then people adding value, as especially the one that's rehabbing it then, because they're going to get, say, you know, $2 increased in market value per $1 spent.
Uh-huh.
So there's a profit to be gained there.
They're building value.
And there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But the appraisals become pretty sophisticated, and that's why we take interior pictures. We have to develop a long list of the repairs that were made. We have to discuss why the thing was purchased at this low number and why. And, you know, so we can do all that. And if we do all that and we do it in enough detail and we do it up front, which I think is important, before it gets submitted to the lender, it gets approved quicker and better and easier if you do it all that way. Everything's disclosed and above board, and there's plenty of data there, and they don't really have many questions after that, because I mean, it's for anybody that's involved in this end of the business, they know that this happens all the time. It's totally legal and it's above board, and this is what it is.
Sure. We just stay away from the term flipping and just use the term wholesale.
Yeah. Flipping just has that stigma attached to it and that
it
connotation,
does.
So it doesn't serve what we do to use that term.
Exactly. Now, I wanted to ask you this about we talked about the different areas that you cover, but what are some of the typical fees?
A typical fee for the full appraisal, like we're talking about, the two-page URAR and all,
which most banks won't.
Which for investor properties or what we're talking about is generally around $300.
Uh-huh.
And now that's in our market.
That's in our market. Yeah, it may be different in some of the other states of people that are listing.
Yeah.
But
and then there's an extra charge for doing the rental analysis and the income analysis, which are either 50 or 75 each for those, so somewhere around, you know, 400 for that.
And, of course, a trip charge for going back to do the completion, right?
Yeah, if that ends up being, it's usually $50 for going back out and doing
uh-huh.
the final. If that's all you had to do on that one is filling out the one-page final and
right.
submitting some pictures, and there's not, it's just a quick trip fee and there's not too much desk work involved in that one.
What about for a drive-by and an electronic or desktop?
Well, the drive-bys get down, you know, 250 to 200. You can even do 150, 175 if they're just, you know, straight refinance.
Slam dunks.
Slam dunks where you don't have to show. Sometimes a lender's going to ask for a comparable actives and pendings in the neighborhood. You know, market data is the support what you're doing,
uh-huh.
and then there's extra forms and all that, and that's why sometimes they're up around 200 or 250. But you can get by, and the AVMs are only like $30.
Uh-huh. Now, what about I used to have one, a Marshall Swift book.
Mm-hmm.
Do appraisers still use that? And if so, tell us a little bit about what that is.
Sure. What we're in our estimate of value, there's three approaches for residential properties that
uh-huh.
that we're asked to complete for the lender. We've been talking about the sales comparison approach. We also have to develop a cost approach, which basically starts with your site value, and then you add the cost of the house minus any depreciation, physical depreciation, if it's not new, which is normally the case. Then you add for your site improvements like your fences and driveways and landscaping and such, and then decks and porches and fireplaces kind of go on top of that too.
Uh-huh.
And you come up with a number, and that number should correlate to your conclusion on your sales price. We seldom ever rely on the cost approach for your final conclusion. It's more of a support analysis. And what you mentioned, the Marshall and Swift, that's the commonly used cost data handbook that we go to figure out primarily your dollars per square foot for certain quality of house, certain size of house, and it's adjusted by region and by market to give you a sense of you know, what's the builder's cost in that.
Right.
It becomes even more, but if a house is 10 years old and we have to figure out depreciation, then it becomes very subjective. But it's still a worthwhile, we still have to put it in there. It's still a worthwhile kind of a check and balance against what your conclusion ends up being. It should be in the ballpark to it. The third approach is the income approach. Even investor properties, lenders generally don't ask us to do that kind of analysis, but it is there on that two-page URAR form. It's simply gross rent times a rent multiplier, and that gives you a number. But it's seldom asked for or done. And, again, it would only be there to support the conclusion of the sales comparison approach, which is almost in all cases, even new houses, where you know your cost is pretty close there on a new house. It should be.
Yeah.
You don't have any depreciation. You're still going to rely, lenders still going to look at the sales comparison approach for determining your value.
Yeah, because you're giving most of the weight to that because that's what the market will bear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And people aren't buying properties. The income approach gets useful in commercial properties and when you're buying things off an income stream.
Right.
Apartment complexes, your capitalization rate. And you're buying things on that basis. You're buying the cash flow and the in that.
Sure.
So
the return on your investment.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's all there on this URAR form, but it's not as detailed and it's not relied on for your conclusion as much.
You know, as an investor, there's a lot of deals out there right now, mobile homes,
mm-hmm.
but they're so tough to get financed as an investor. Talk a little bit about, from an appraisal standpoint, the difference between a manufactured home and a modular home.
Well, there is a clearer definition in the last, I guess, year or so. Now we have, at least in our state, I would assume they've done this federally, there's a state modular stamp that when we inspect the property, we look for. And this basically can be earned by the manufactured home plant by upping their standards and their quality of construction, and the things are inspected in
uh-huh.
more detail at the plant, and they earn this modular stamp. And it seems oftentimes you can't tell from the exterior. They'll look very much the same, the same lower-pitched roof, but when you go inside, some of them, not all of them, but some of them will have drywalls. You know, they'll have stud walls with the drywall, and they'll have, I guess, their floor joists are more like a site-built home where they support the subfloor, you know, where
right.
it doesn't move. And you can't have a higher-pitched roof, and you've got some more custom features here and there. But even if it's modular, the quality of construction still varies a good bit from one to another. But practically speaking, if it's got a modular stamp, when we appraise it, we're then allowed to compare it to site-built homes.
Are you really, you're able to use site-built comparables?
Yeah. In fact, we're practically mandated to do such because there's, as you know, there's different lending packages, and if we say something about it being a double wide and it's not a module, you know, say it is a modular, and we don't treat it that way, and the lender can't get the proper financing, we become liable because we've caused that.
Wow.
So our comp should be other modulars or site-built and not double-wide.
Does it matter whether the modular is on-frame or off-frame, and can you explain that for people that may not be familiar?
No, it doesn't. Of course, I'm not an expert on manufactured housing, but it doesn't matter whether it's off-frame or on-frame. It's
wow.
simply a matter of if it's got that modular stamp, whether it's earned that or not. Almost all of them are, well, the ones I've seen around here are still on-frame.
Uh-huh.
They've only earned the ones I've seen that modular stamp by increasing a little bit on the quality of the construction there at the factory, but they're still assembled in two pieces in the field. Now, there is even higher modular housing. I mean, that being said, there's a lot being done on modular housing where, you know, full wall panels they are brought in,
uh-huh.
and there's more of it being done in the field than bringing in full completed sections. But it's,
right.
you know, the walls are brought in, the roofs are brought in one piece, and you can have 1.5 and 2-story modular homes that
right.
have taken on the appearance.
Panelized housing, I think they call it a lot of times. Panelized housing, I think they call it.
Mm-hmm. And that's becoming more and more accepted, you know, in the marketplace, and appraisers should be valuing those closer to site built. And but that's not to be said that we don't make an adjustment for the quality of construction, because you're not going to compare that to a spec house or, you know, brick, you know, full brick house and things like that. But
right.
But each market is different, and as far as the acceptance within the market and what are they worth and valued, and you know, what's your, you know, how would they sell and be received is a matter of your own market.
I had heard at one point, and this is maybe a year or two ago, that an appraiser is not supposed to use as a comp dealer sales on manufactured or modular homes when doing an appraisal for a resale or a refinance.
That's right.
Is that true?
That's true.
Okay.
That's
Do you know why that is?
Basically because I think the integrity of these sales contracts is not very good.
Okay.
They're sold all over the place, high and low, based on
what the person can afford.
What they can afford, and they come in and ask, "What's my payment?" And they don't. And instead of what's my pay, you know, what's my total price on
right,
it?
Right, I'm with you.
And these are end up being more worksheets than I've seen than they are sales contracts.
Right. Okay.
And there's things factored in, you know, and it's similar to really new construction. You know, when I have to do a new home, new site-built home in a neighborhood, I can't use three new sales. My three comps can't be the three from that neighborhood, because you want competing data for other neighborhoods, and you really want a resale in there, because, you know, you can overpay. You know, you can, you know, if you bought a house and you tell the builder that you want this, this, and this, and you can run up the cost another $20,000, well, you've got a sales contract, and you've paid that.
Yeah.
But often you can over-improve it
uh-huh.
and do things that you're not going to get back in market value. So you know, a sales contract, even in those cases, can be inflated and are not that accurate. It's more resale. Okay, 2 years later, what did you get for that house? Or a year later, sometimes, you know, we'll be lucky and find sales that, in a new subdivision that, for one reason, you know, had to turn over fairly quickly. And so a lender wants different data from different neighborhoods, because that kind of makes them feel better about the integrity of the data that's out there.
Sure.
And so, yeah, that's a Fannie Mae federal guideline that we can't use the contract sales. We have to, which makes it very difficult to appraise manufactured houses, because we have to find, again, we prefer MLS,
uh-huh.
but you have to find resales of manufactured homes. And,
uh-huh.
and at least around here, there's a high percentage of them are distressed properties. So those values are lower.
Right.
And so that doesn't necessarily give you a true market value.
That's a really good point. That is a good point.
Yeah. Now that being said, as far as our selection of comparables, whether it's manufactured home or like we were talking about with investor properties and just refinances and such, we're not, if we find distress sales, MLS sales in the neighborhood, And we know that, and you can tell from the listing sheet, it's bank-owned property, as-is, need repairs, addendums required, all that.
Sure.
Or it's a relocation appraisal with some or situation, or, you know, where they had to turn it quick, and, you know, the company bought it and it sold. If these are low sales and what we call below-market sales,
uh-huh.
we can discount those. We have the discretion not to use those.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, they shouldn't be used if they sold for below market.
Sure, if there were unique situations.
Yeah. Now, if our subject is a distressed sale, then I should be using those because they are comparable.
Right.
But we're talking about homes that have been repaired, they're in good shape, they show well.
They've been fixed up to resale.
Yeah.
Right.
So these sales are out there, and we can discount them. But finding good manufactured home comps is a challenge for, at least I know that, for our market.
Wow.
Because they sell from, you know, all over the board. From
You're right there.
The same square footage from 35,000 to 85,000.
Now, you mentioned federal guidelines a while ago. Who is it that regulates appraisers?
The feds primarily, and then at the state level as well.
Okay.
But we have to comply with what we call USPAP, which is the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. And all appraisers have to adhere to these codes. They tell us how we are to appraise property and how we are to report the property, the appraisal.
Mm-hmm. They give you the standard forms and all that.
And the standards of actually what you have to do in the field. It's comprehensive, inch and a half thick kind of a manual of how we have to do things.
Sure.
But it really boils down to doing the job properly,
right,
reporting it properly, don't be misleading, and then there's ethics clauses that go throughout. Don't intentionally mislead anybody, you can't inflate, and you can't, you have to... It's basically you just have to do it right. If you do it right and you report it correctly and you don't mislead people, you're not going to get you're going to be fine. But it does change. The language in these things changes from every 2 years or so. It's updated and there's some updates coming out like we talked about with comparables. But each appraiser is mandated by the requirements that are in that and to keep a state license. So. And appraisers get disciplinary action. They can lose their license. It goes on all the time because they didn't adhere to these standards.
Yeah.
Knowingly or unknowingly. And so when you ask an appraiser to do certain things, he may say, I can't do that. And that's the reason.
Exactly, because you guys have a lot of rules.
Well,
it's pretty tight, too.
Well, we're supposed to be an integral part of the lending institutions and the practice. And these, as you know, the banks package and bundle these things and sell them in securities on the exchanges. And so it's just one little appraiser doing one appraisal report. But when you take them all in together and there's thousands of them or hundreds of thousands of them and they're bundled in, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and we don't want one, they want to know that the integrity of the data and the reports is there.
And that's why it's uniform, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. I actually have a 2003 USPAP appraisal standards manual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, man, this is a thick manual here, too.
Yeah. And we have to take continuing education, which every 2 years involves having to take an update course on USPAP.
I think that's where I actually got this, is I took a CE class, continuing education, for the mortgage business, and it was about appraisals, and that's where I got this.
Yeah, it's not a fun seminar to have to go to. It's the most boring that we've got, but it's necessary and important.
Sure, absolutely. You've got to keep up on what's going on.
Yeah, and it's a far... appraising now is, for the guys that have been around a while, it's much different, I guess, than the old days when the guy walked out and with his clipboard and said, "Well, yeah, what do you need?" And they wrote it down. And
really, what do you need?
and that's where some of the problems came from. And
those guys are in jail now.
And it wasn't the S&L crisis wasn't from residential property; it was commercial things. But still, it all boils down to doing it right,
Well, it's like I say, do it right, sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't have to worry about it, right?
That's the way I look at it.
Brad, there's a lot of people, whether they're out of town, what are some qualities and some things that a person needs to look for in finding a good appraiser to build and get on their dream team?
Well, I certainly they have to be what we call state certified.
Uh-huh.
And make sure that they're knowledgeable in your market. You want someone that's based near you. That's not driving, three counties over to do work where you're at. Now, depending where you're at, if you're not in a large market metropolitan area, you won't find necessarily a full-time appraiser.
Right.
Right local to you there. But that's a hard one to answer because. As most people realize, in any profession, there are people that are good at what they do, and they run the gamut,
mm-hmm.
and I guess referrals is a good way to start with. And
I think it's also important to find somebody that knows the investor market. that knows doing subject to or as repaired appraisals? Because there's some appraisers that don't do that. Isn't that correct?
Well, yeah, and I've really learned a lot from doing it and with you guys, where we had to do now add things and do stuff, and now we just do it as a matter of standard practice. And
right.
We kind of learn together, and you kind of learn from underwriting, and things do evolve and change. So I guess you want someone that's been doing it a while, is experienced but not so experienced that they're set in their ways, and you want someone that's automated, because we do not now, as an example, where we used to print out reports and deliver them or mail them somewhere and glue the pictures onto the form, for some time now I haven't done any of those. They're all electronic. So it's digital cameras, it's scanning, it's downloading things from the Internet for your maps and
email
flood
appraisals.
Data, and then they're all emailed to the lender.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to find someone there's people that still don't work like that, and so you want to find someone that's kept up with the technology.
Somebody that's not technologically challenged.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all technologically challenged. I only learn about as much as I have to learn, but it's always something. And you're glad you did it when you finally get it worked out, because it really does help us to do a better job and do a quicker job, and that's what you're gonna want from your appraiser, because lenders more and more are going to that, and they're going to ask for that. So if you want an ongoing relationship, you need a guy that's keeping up with the technology. And
absolutely.
You know, that being said, even though they're state licensed, you know, some haven't kept up with it.
I think another thing too is, when you're looking for an appraiser to become a part of your team, it needs to be somebody that, number one, has good, strong ethics and morals and is not going to be swayed. Although, like you mentioned earlier, more information, if a person can give you other comps or more sales or whatever that can help justify, those things are all good. But you need somebody that is going to stick to their guns and say, hey, do you want a good appraisal or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that goes with anybody on your team. You want that. You want those character traits, because if you want to be doing it for long term and doing it right, it's essential, because you end up getting a reputation with the lenders or the people you work with if you're not doing it right.
That's true.
If you ask an appraiser to do something and he says he can't do it, or you want it inflated $5,000 and it may help in that one case, but in the long run it's going to be a problem. So
sure.
A good appraiser should be fair with you, because it is an estimate of value, and if you fixed it up and you've done it right, you deserve to be at a higher range for where your comparables are at, and that's all you can ask them to do. But
absolutely.
If he comes in consistently, if they end up being conservative on you, then that's not fair either. But you can't ask them to inflate things, because it's going to get caught and it's going to get picked up with the lender and the underwriting, and it's going to be a problem.
You're exactly right, and I think that's very important to point out, that it needs to be not only somebody that does have ethics and morals, but somebody you can communicate with in the event you have a situation where, you may feel like you there's more value there, and they're not afraid to talk to you about it, but you're also not afraid to tell them, hey, here's what I found, here's how I justified this, here's why I can't go anymore, and let's do this one and move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should be able to have an open conversation with your appraiser.
Absolutely, and good service is important too.
Yeah, everybody wants them quick, so we try to stay on the move.
Exactly. Yeah, you're out doing two a day, aren't you?
Well, it changes. So you can't. You try to group them together by location, so you're not doing, because the driving time is the downtime.
Right.
So say we go to for Fred, we're doing Gaston County today. I'll even call him and say, hey, you got any others you haven't told me about yet? So I'm here, and we do all the inspections I can in Gaston that day.
Sure.
And so the next day may be just all sitting in the office, working on the reports kind of thing. So it ebbs and flows, but I try to group them by location. I find I can get more done, get them done quicker that way.
And that's a good point. And speaking of Fred, who is a good friend of both of ours, in fact, I met you through Fred. something like that.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Man, I'm telling you, it's been a long time. But I don't know if you know it or not yet, Brad, but Fred and I are going to be doing a rehab bus tour.
I saw that on my memo tonight that came in.
Yeah, it's going to be at on March 5th. We're going to meet over in Charlotte. We've chartered a bus, a huge bus that has a bathroom built in it and all that good stuff. And we're going to leave early in the morning, about 8:30, and we're going to go around and tour properties. Mm. And Fred's going to show us, I don't know, maybe 4, 5, 6 different properties, or maybe more, that he has under different stages of rehab. He's going to show us, you know, why he bought them, how he bought them, how he structured everything, how he determined whether this was a good rental versus a retail, how much work he was going to do to each one of them, how he determined that, dealing with contractors, inspectors, and inspections on the property, and how to set himself up for success in the whole rehab process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a great learning experience, and I'm really excited about it. In fact, I just shot out an email last week, and Fred was on the teleconference last week, and I think we only have maybe 28 or 29 seats left, something like that. I got a couple orders just this afternoon, so I think we have maybe 26 or 27 seats left. But I know it'll sell out, but anybody that wants to register for that, you can go right on our website at www.LarryGoins.com, and there's a picture of a big bus there, and just scroll down a little bit, it tells about it, and there's a button to click on to register. It's only $69, and we're going to, when you register, you will receive an email telling you when and where to show up on that Saturday morning, and we're going to go out and tour about a half a day. We'll come back around 12:30 to 1. We're going to have lunch, which we can't pay for lunch at $69, but and Wendy Sweet, my partner here at Financial Help, will come in, and she's going to talk about creatively financing your deals with no money down and how to set yourself up to get your loans closed fast and get organized with your financing. So that'll be pretty neat. That's a little added bonus there. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm sure that thing will sell out pretty quick, but we're looking forward to that. Well, Brad, I really appreciate having you on tonight. It's been a lot of fun. Man, it's been a tremendous amount of information. I have a page and a half of notes here.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I hope I answered some of the questions, and I enjoy working with you guys over there.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. Like you said, time flies when you're having fun. Let me ask you this question. Would you like to give out your contact information in the event someone would like to contact you to do an appraisal or if they have questions?
Yeah, sure. Let me give out a couple numbers and
sure.
My email, I guess. The office phone number is area code 704-846-2745. The fax number, 704-846-0323, or you can send me an email. I don't have a website. Generally, my business comes direct from the client, so we haven't had that set up, nor do I anticipate it. But you can send me an email at bkroll@carolina.rr.com. And the market areas I cover, since I'm based in Mecklenburg County here in Charlotte, I go one county out in all directions, which is Gaston County, Union County, Iredell County, Cabarrus County, and sometimes a little further than that. I'm actually licensed in South Carolina as well. I do those two counties of York and Lancaster down there from time to time.
You do Lancaster too?
If I have to.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's a long county. You can about go to Camden.
You go to
Lancaster County. Well, you almost. When I say do Lancaster, and people take me up on it, I end up having. It's a long, long county.
Oh, I know. Camden's almost to Columbia.
Yeah, it's way down there.
Just north of Columbia,
but
you hang a left.
Larry, you can't pick and choose the easy ones. You
That's
can't just
true.
Do the easy ones. Sometimes you have to do the hard ones that come your way too. So
you take the good with the bad, right?
I take the good with the bad, and all averages out just fine. And,
wow.
And yeah, we try to serve. Like I say, if you got clients and they got work in those areas, and then you try to make an effort to take care of their clients. And
absolutely,
so it
absolutely.
It takes me in those directions. But yeah, if I can help anybody on straight residential, we also do duplexes, triplexes, and up to fourplexes. as a residential appraiser. Anything past that, you need a commercial appraiser for bigger, you know, eightplexes or apartment buildings and commercial properties.
Which, from a lending standpoint, everything up to four units is considered single family or residential.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that really helps. Brad, I really appreciate having you on here. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks again. Well, glad to help out the next time appraisers don't get invited too many places, so thanks for the attention.
I hear you. And if anybody would like to register for the Rehab Bus Tour, just visit www.larrygoins.com. And you can also register for our newsletter if you're not already a subscriber there. And thanks a lot, everybody, for calling in. I really appreciate it, and I hope everybody has a great night. And, Brad, thank you, and you have a great night, too.
Okay, thanks. It's been fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Larry Goins, and I would like to thank you for listening to this audio program. I would also like to remind you to please visit our website at www.larrygoins.com for other information, as well as we have a link for freebies. We have articles that you can read. I would like to share with you that we also offer one-day training events for basic real estate investing, and we also have three-day boot camps, as well as the boot camp in a box, which contains the complete three-day boot camp on audio CD as well as DVD video. Please visit our website for the location and schedule of our one-day and three-day boot camps coming up. We also have a home study course called The Complete Insider's Guide to Financing for Investors, which consists of over 500 pages in the manual and 10 audio CDs, as well as two forms disc and other products and services as well. We also offer personal coaching and mentoring, so whatever your needs may be, please feel free to give us a call. If you are a real estate group, investor association, mortgage company owner, or other organization and would like to have either myself or Wendy Sweet or Leon Humphrey speak at your group about real estate and finance and investing, please feel free to give us a call. Our direct office number is 803-831-0056. I am at extension 304. Wendy Sweet is 310. I'd also like to remind you that we also offer traditional financing as well as hard money and rehab loans for investors. Please visit our website there at www.financialhelpservices.com. Thank you very much for your business. We sincerely appreciate it. And please remember, our mission is to put people and principles in front of profits. When we do that, everybody profits. Thank you and have a great day.